Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat podcast. I'm Sam Moores and today we have Simon Owen here. Hello.
Hi Sam. Yeah, Simon Owen here from BRM, director of BRM and grandson of Sir Alfred Owen, the well, I guess he was the original, one of the original owners of BRM, bought it in 1953. And I'm lucky enough with my cousins and my father to be in control of BRM at the moment.
That's very cool. Now, I would say, normally I would say, how did you get into all this? Well, clearly, but you were sort of born into it. But this whole new era of BRM, I guess, or sort of bringing back a bit of the memories. Tell me about this idea and your journey to this point, I guess.
Yeah, no problem. I guess it goes back probably 4 or 5 years ago, having a conversation with a couple of my cousins, Paul Owen in particular, about BRM. Growing up with as a young man, I was always aware of BRM, but yeah, I was distracted with other businesses and other things. And we suddenly sort of started talking about it, realizing that actually it was something very cool that, you know, we weren't really doing anything with as a family company, because Rubri Owen, the family company, sort of ultimately owns BRM Limited.
Yeah.
And so we spoke about trying to do something with it. And, you know, as a family company, it's got 40 odd shareholders with lots of different views. Not everyone understood the potential merits of a heritage Formula One brand. So we spent sort of 2 or 3 years trying to persuade the board and some of the shareholders that it was a pretty cool asset to go and go and celebrate, actually, go and do something with. But at the end of that sort of period, it sort of seemed that they weren't as enthusiastic as the minority. So we decided to, said, well, look, if you're not interested, we are. We'll take a license. So my father, John Owen, son of Sir Alfred Owen, Nick Owen, Paul Owen, and myself, took the license off Rubri Owen, who supported us with that, and are continuing to support us in the journey of bringing it back to life.
It sounds like it's a pretty interesting thing to be doing. Have you been, but up to this point, have you been like a mad petrol head and been heavily into this sort of history?
Yeah. I mean, embarrassingly, I know very little about cars. I have no idea how they work, which is ironic. But I thought I'd get that out quickly before you start asking me technical questions. I love cars. I love the way they look, love the way they sound, love the way they smell. I've become far more of a petrol head on this journey. But I suppose the thing that really sort of got me fired up about it was in 1981 when, during the recession, the great industrial company that was Rubri Owen was struggling in the early 80s. And in 1981, unfortunately, we had to sell a lot of our assets, including BRM, or not BRM, but some of the BRMs. And so as a sort of a wee 10-year-old, I was taken to this auction to see these beautiful cars being sold off. And I'll never forget my old man sort of picking me up and putting me in a V16 at age 10. I didn't really understand the significance of it at the time. Yeah. But that sort of obviously sowed a seed. And, to be able to work with my father 40 years later to bring back the name and to build a new another V16 is incredibly powerful, I think. To have that opportunity, I'm feeling incredibly privileged.
Yeah, it's being that sort of age, you're just around those things. Like you being around those things, you're just like, oh yeah, it's a cool car. Like, get in it, and then you look back and you're like, oh no, they were really cool cars.
Well, exactly, and I think not many people realize that we gave Niki Lauda his first drive in Formula One, and that was more my era really, where I started to sort of see the Marlboro cars and actually understand that they were BRMs and they were cool. As a sort of early 20s man going off to university and pursuing another career, BRM sort of took a back seat, and it wasn't until much later that we realized collectively that actually we had an incredible asset here and we should do something with it.
Yeah. I'll admit my knowledge of BRM is pretty limited until this morning of some Googling. I'm quite a late comer into the party. I'm also a bit younger than you. And they weren't really around when I was sort of paying attention to TVs.
That's the whole point, is that, back in the 60s, it was, very much, Ferrari and BRM going toe-to-toe. Obviously, Ferrari carried on, did road cars. BRM stopped in 1974. So we raced, in F1 in 1950 to 1974, when Sir Alfred was told it was going to cost £1 million to run the team, and said, well, enough's enough. And we've got a business to run. This thing's got out of control. So that's what happened. And thankfully, because of the work of the BRMA, the British Racing Motors Association, and Hall and Hall and Bourne, the name has sort of been kept alive by them, to which we're incredibly grateful. But I think if we're going to talk about BRM and sort of educate people about BRM, BRM was Britain's first Formula One team. The P15, the V16 was Britain's first Formula One car, which is pretty special, to be fair. When you look at that car, 36,000 individually engineered parts, it's a phenomenal thing. It was way ahead of its time. And produced figures, here's a layman speaking, but we've got 627 brake horsepower out of a 1.5-liter engine that was basically conceived in 1946. That's pretty phenomenal. Fangio was purported to have gone 200 miles an hour in 1953 at Albi. So when you look at those sort of figures now, they're still astounding. So you can imagine what they were like in period.
It completely blows my mind, like these sorts of cars. Like looking up some of the details on this one. And yeah, the sort of horsepower figures, the size of the engine, the number of cylinders. But then like the performance, like it's like 0 to 60s. The numbers I came across, and I'm sure it's been revised now in the more modern one, but the 0 to 60 under 4 seconds and over 190 miles an hour. Like, That's not embarrassing for a modern supercar.
Exactly. Well, exactly. And that's the thing, you know, we want to tell this story because not many people know about it. And yeah, you are younger than me. Thank you for pointing that out. But you don't know about BRM. And that's what we're doing this project about, because we want to tell the story. We can tell it authentically because we're the Owen family. We've owned it ever since 1953. So we're able to tell it, the story authentically. We want to tell it to a new audience. We want to tell it to the likes of yourselves that love motorsport, that maybe have heard of it, maybe it haven't, but don't know much about it. And ultimately, we want to go racing again. What that looks like remains to be seen, but we've built a car and we want to race it. We want people to see it and hear it and smell it. And it's a very special thing. You only have to look online at the comments that we get every time that thing is fired up. People get very excited. In an age where everything's moving bizarrely to electric, this thing becomes ever more special.
Because was it pitched as, did it end up, it was going to be, or sort of, you were trying to pitch it as the Great Britain team at the same time, initially?
Yeah. Yeah, well, back in the day, post-war, the motorsport was dominated by the Italians, the French, and the Germans. There was no real British, other than the ERAs prior to the war, there wasn't really any British motorsport teams out there. So the founder, Raymond Mays, was an incredible man, visionary, really, had a vision to take on the might of the Europeans. But his vision was to have a British car designed in Britain, built in Britain with all British parts and driven by a British driver to take on the world and win the world championship. That was his vision, which is, an astonishing vision. And there were many other teams that sort of came and went, and, still around, Van Wall, Lotus, that did that, but they didn't do it to the same vision. They compromised on the parts they used. They weren't British. Maybe the driver wasn't British. But, it took us until 1962, which is our 60th anniversary this year, which is why we're celebrating it, for Graham Hill to get over the line and pit Lotus to the World Championship. And that's an incredible vision to have stuck through thick and thin. From 1949 and the embarrassment of 1950 when we broke a drive shaft at Silverstone in front of the world, in front of royalty. That was an incredible tenacity to keep going and to not waver from that vision, and showcase British engineering excellence, and to get us over the line for World Championship with Graham Hill in 1962, which was we're very, very proud of. And we were runner-up 4 times after that. So, that's an incredible feat. And not many people sort of understand that, because we stopped racing in 1974. So there's this big gap. There's a generation or two that need to be brought up to date.
Yeah. Just reading into it a little bit, it sounds like the sort of engineering that went into these V16 cars you will know all of the details on this, but it sounded like they were sort of going after aircraft quality rather than road car quality in like all of the things. Can you explain, like, yeah. It sounds like a lot of parts of it were almost significantly more complicated, definitely the engine, than other people, but because of this ethos.
100%. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think if you think post-war, you know, we're talking 1946, 47, when this whole project sort of started. Where was technology? Technology was in aircrafts. It was in the aircraft industry because of the war. And so obviously all that engineering and technical know-how and expertise had gone into aircraft. So obviously trying to use some of that technology and bring it into motorsport racing was what we're about. And the classic example is, you know, some of the struts are from fighter aircraft, you know, the suspension struts. The supercharger in the V16 is a downscaled supercharger from a Spitfire Merlin engine. So, you know, these are astonishing things. I think the tachometer was adapted from a Wellington bomber. So, you know, they used the technology that was there, you know, to you know, make the best car possible. And that was the thing. It was all about not compromising. It was all about producing the very best car that was possible, however ambitious, however seemingly stupid. They would pursue that, and it was incredibly complicated. If there were two ways of doing it, VRM would do it the hard way, and they would do it the hard way because the engineering might take more time or more money. They just didn't compromise on it, and sometimes that was to their detriment because there was reliability issues at the beginning, but by the end of 1953-54, the V16 was incredibly efficient and not fuel efficient, I might add. I think it does about six miles to the gallon, but yeah. It was a pretty reliable car, and that's the car that we've built. So we want to showcase that. But the one point I would say, and you know, I'm fixated on the V16, and my cousins tease me about this, but the level of engineering that went into the V16 was the level of engineering that went into every BRM. And you know, BRM was renowned for its engineering, the quality of the engineering, and the quality of the parts that went into it, which makes it very special. We didn't compromise. We didn't go and over to Italy or to France or to somewhere else to go and get some other parts. We built them and designed them ourselves. Only Ferrari and only BRM are the only two world championship teams that designed and built their own cars, which is an incredible testament to BRM and to the people in Bourne and to British engineering. Because when this whole venture started, it was very much, you know, Raymond Mays went round cap in hand to 200 of the great British industrialists at the time saying, yeah, I've got this vision, can you help? You know, Lucas was involved and my grandfather, obviously. And it was only through the support of those people that this thing got off the ground. And it became known as, BRM became known as the ambassador for Britain. Nice. So it was not just about building a race team. It was about international prestige for British engineering after the war. And that's what this was. And that's why we often say that we hold the BRM name in trust for the nation. You know, we don't own it. We hold it in trust for the nation, and we're very proud of that. And we're just custodians of it. You know, our grandfather, Sir Alfred Owen, was owned it, but he wasn't the engineer. He wasn't the man on the ground building the cars and doing all the hard graft. That came from the people in Bourne.
Yeah. No, it sounds like this sort of technical showcase of doing things properly, doing things well, trying to do things as best as possible is really it's a really cool thing. I remember I was just looking up, and then one bit of text that I came across was like the rev counter alone must have had 50 pieces in it. And you're like,
exactly.
Compared to some other stuff,
of course, it's ridiculous. Yeah, we could have gone and bought something off the shelf. But no, we'd adapt a Wellington bomber tachometer and try and make it work because the engineering would be better and it looked better and blah, blah, blah. It's madness, especially these days. But actually, that's what makes it so special is that there was no compromise. And they stuck to their guns and they stuck to their vision. I think one of the things that's really struck home to me is that level of engineering is only now really beginning to get appreciated. And the world's largest sort of collector of BRMs happens to be Richard Mille, the fantastic watchmaker and incredible brand. And I think that's testament to the level of engineering that goes into all the BRM cars.
Yeah. Has it been interesting going sort of back? Because you then, to rebuild one of these cars, presumably you've had to go back and look at one, all the initial drawings, but also presumably one of the cars or the cars, and really like dig back into them and all the details and then the processes to make them. Has that been quite an interesting and sort of almost surprising process in parts, maybe?
It's been an incredible journey. I can't take any credit for any of it, really. That goes to Hall and Hall in Bourne, who live and breathe BRM. And the one thing that I would say is that we have 20,000 of the original drawings. And those things are a work of art in themselves. Hand-drawn from 1946, they go back to. They are absolutely beautiful. And we've got, I would have probably thought, 95% of what we need to build any BRM. With the V16 or the P15 V16, there were a couple of things that or a couple of plans missing, but I think we could we used the original chassis one from Bewley and another car to help reverse engineer some of the parts of the car. But the whole project is the fact that we have owned the name and the mark since 1953. So all we're doing is building another one.
Yeah.
People talk about replicas and continuation cars. We see it as we're just building another car. Going through the archive, we found that there were six original P15s due to be built. Only three were built in period of the Mark 1s. So, as far as we're concerned, we've gone back and we're fulfilling what was going to be done in period by building six. Chassis 4 is, it's my father's car that he commissioned to get the project underway. Chassis 5 is being built, and you might not have seen, but there's just been a press release out there. We found the original body buck of the P15. So Richard Mille is commissioning that car to be built for the first time for 70 years in the original shape that it was unveiled in 15th of December 1949. So that's incredibly exciting for us to see that car. And then we're only going to build one more. So there's chassis 6 that is available to the right home. And when I say the right home, it's got to be someone that appreciates the car, that will run the car, because the whole project's about sharing the story with motorsport fans and a new generation. We don't want them under a dust sheet, hidden away, just for a couple of individuals to enjoy. They need to be out there and spreading the good news.
Yeah. If someone wants to buy that last car, how much is it?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question. I'm not at liberty to say, I don't think, but it'll be quite a lot of money. As you can imagine, 18 months of of hard graft, 36,000 individual parts. It's going to be a lot of money. But yeah, if anyone's interested and they're the right people, then yeah, we'll have a conversation.
POA. Fair enough.
POA.
So the cars you've been building now, are they going to be exactly the same as the earlier ones, or have minor things been tweaked just for like running better and things like that?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. We are and Hall and Hall are absolutely sticklers for detail and for keeping things as genuine and as authentic as possible. So the only thing, again, I'm not technical, but the only thing that I believe has been upgraded are the magnetos, which help just to keep it running smoother. Mm. Other than that, we've done absolutely everything to keep it as per the original drawings. So it's identical. Obviously, the quality of steel or the parts, we're using modern materials, so that might be beneficial, but the specification is exactly the same. We're not looking to improve the performance of the car. We're not looking to make it something it's not. It is 100% original as far as we're concerned. And we're doing that for many reasons, but we want to be able to go to Monaco. We want to be able to go to Goodwood, hand on heart, and say this is an authentic car.
Yeah.
We will not compromise on that. And others do, we won't.
And if you bought this car, you could run it at Revival, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, indeed. So Chassis 4, the one that's just been built, ran at Goodwood, and we're hoping we'll run at Revival this year. In what capacity is TBC, but the idea is we want to race it. We want to see the car racing under full, in full chat, that hasn't been done for years. The chassis number one Bewley car is a very, very special thing, but it's held in trust and it can't race. Okay. Chassis two has just been rebuilt. Chassis three was written off in period, and chassis four is my father's car, and chassis five's underway. So, so at the moment it's looking like only chassis four will be racing in earnest. But that's the plan.
Have you been behind the wheel?
I've been behind the wheel, not brave enough to drive it quite yet. It's actually quite tight. I'm 6'5" and it's actually quite tight. I think it was built for a man of a slightly shorter stature and bigger girth. the likes of Gonzalez and Fangio seem to slip in and out very easily. I look like a sort of folding giraffe trying to get in. I think when the old man took his took delivery of the car up in Blyton, I thought we were going to have to get an ambulance to get him out. He was sort of stuck in there, and we left him on the runway for a few minutes, which was quite entertaining. But it is pretty tight in there. But I think, look, the end of the day, I would love to drive it. I think when you've got that level of power kicking in through a supercharger, you need to know what you're doing. There's only a few people on the planet that know how to drive a V16 well. Rob Hall and Rick Hall and Andy at Hall and Hall are some of the best drivers of V16s on the planet. I'm hoping that they'll take me out in a P25, give me some instructions, and eventually I'll get to drive it. The old man hasn't driven it yet. He's hoping to drive it at the BRMA day up at Blyton in a few months' time. Mm. And that'll be a very, very special moment for him to drive the car that he watched in period as a kid holding his dad's hand. So
that's cool.
Yeah, it's Yeah, it is very, very cool. The whole project's amazing.
I've never driven anything remotely like that at all. And I can't get my head around. I sort of understand the people that raced it back in the day driving them now, because that's sort of, you know, if you drive a car that's made today and then you drive it in 100 years, but it was made today, I'd be fine with that. But the idea of sitting in something that was made back then with like skinny tires, you say 600 horsepower, like, does it even have a seatbelt? Probably not.
No, don't be silly. Not having a seatbelt actually saved a few people's lives when those things, they get jettisoned out. But yeah. No, look, those guys, again, if you take yourself back to, to the late 40s, early 50s, there was very much post-war feeling, you know, they're like fighter pilots. People used to die every week in race cars. And I'm not saying it was the norm, but it was, it's not like it is, you know, now, thankfully. I'm proud to say, because of the work that Louis Stanley did and Jackie Stewart in the 60s, BRM were at the forefront of safety in Formula One, which is something, you know, we want to celebrate and you know, tell people about the incredible work they did in safety.
Yeah.
But you know, to answer your question, I think they were very brave men getting into those cars without seat belts, put on a little leather hat, put the goggles down, light a fag, and off you go. But yeah, you know, wasn't it great? Wasn't it great to watch those guys sliding around the skinny tires with all that power and trying to control it in the wet? You know, some of the drives that Wharton and Parnell performed at Goodwood. You know, when we got 1, 2, 3 at Goodwood, just astonishing. The control of those cars. Fantastic to behold. And I guess we're very, very lucky insofar as we've got probably, according to the great historian, motorsport historian Doug Nye, we've got probably the best motorsport archive on the planet. It really is incredible. We've got minutes of every meeting from 1946. Oh, cool. Right the way through to 74. We've got 20,000 drawings. Rubrio had commissioned a production company very early on. So we've got thousands of hours of never before seen Formula One footage that we're going through at the moment, trying to digitize and get our heads around. So, we're very, very fortunate to have all the assets that we have to be able to tell the story. And we're looking forward to doing that over the next sort of 10, 15 years.
It's so cool to have kept that stuff. Like on a sort of small level now, I've recently come across some video footage of like my dad 45 years ago. And it's that sort of thing, I think, for our generation and sort of like moving forward, there's going to be so much video footage around as long as people don't lose it. But it's not interesting. I personally, it hasn't been interesting for me for like 25 years. But now I'm like, no, it's really cool seeing my dad, my age, but back then. And seeing all this footage now of then means so much. Whereas like 10 years after it was filmed, no one cares. But you have to wait that long period of time. And then suddenly it sort of like snaps into focus and you're like, oh my God, this is amazing.
Well, you've just hit the nail on the head, really, as to how, I got involved in the project with my cousins. But for some reason, you wait a certain period and you're not waiting, but you suddenly realize and it hits you suddenly that actually that is very cool. That is something I do want to go back and revisit. And that's what happened with this project. It was under our noses and all around us for, 2 decades before we really realized that there was something there to pick up and run with. And it's bizarre, but, I should have done it sooner.
Yeah. Yeah. It's well, you're doing it now and it's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah. Well, at least I'm doing it now. Yeah,
exactly. The V16 engine, 1.5 liters. 16 cylinders. That is like just trying to even just, I don't think I've seen the car, but like trying to picture that engine when you get like 6 liter American V8s or whatever, like these tiny little cylinders and there's just tons of crazy amount of mechanical stuff all going, is in period, were there problems getting this engine to work and run well?
Absolutely. It's a very complicated thing. I think, yeah, as I alluded to earlier, at the beginning of the V16's life, it was unreliable. There were issues, but when it was running well, like it did in sort of 51 and at the end of 50 and beyond, it did become pretty reliable. And speaking to Rick Hall and Rob Hall at Hall & Hall, who have built the car, they do believe that if it's looked after and maintained properly, that it can be a very reliable car, which I find astonishing when, you know, as a layman, I open the hood and look inside. I'm like, how on earth did anyone dream that thing up? And how does it work? I've just absolutely no idea. But it's, you're absolutely right. It is a complicated thing. But I think, you know, with just with the magnetos, I think that's made a huge difference in the running of the car. We've had chassis 4 out a few times, and it's run perfectly every time. As I say, this year we're hoping to run it properly and to have it at full chat. One of the things that I'm very keen to do is to do a sound recording of the car. Up at 11,500-12,000 revs, which is when it really starts to sing. I've never heard it personally, so I want to hear it there. My old man wants to hear it. I think everyone wants to hear it. You know, people, we're contacted every day by people saying, you know, when are you going to race it? When can we hear it? Because even at Goodwood last year, speaking to Rob Hall, he got it up to 9,000 revs, maybe nine and a half. But it's that last, 2.5, 3,500, that makes a huge difference to the sound of the engine.
Huge difference.
And also the Mark IIs, the P30s, they had stub exhaust. And we were very lucky to have a couple of those at Goodwood last year. And they've got stub exhaust, which sound even louder. So, we're thinking about just popping some stub exhausts on the Mark One, which it had in period at one stage. So,
selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
We're very, very much able to do so and do the sound recording. The problem is, it's finding somewhere that can deal with the noise, because every track has noisy days. But this is a different level of a noisy day.
That will be quite something.
Yeah, but it's that noise, I guess. I don't know if you've seen any of the sort of short films we've done, but we shot the first film, the Reawakening, which is all about the brand coming back to life, with the V16 engine, one of the original V16 engines on the dyno at RAF Fockingham in Lincolnshire. And that was in one of the original BRM outbuildings that was at RAF Fockingham, where they launched the car in 1949. So for us, it was really important to go back to where it all started and for that engine to start up. But during making of that film, Hall and Hall got a phone call from someone and said, from a village about 5 miles away from Fockingham, and said, is that a V16 I can hear? I've opened my window so I can hear it better. It's glorious. Keep it coming. And that gave me the sort of inspiration for the follow-up film, which is The Chrysalis, which is all about people's reaction in and around Bourne to the sound of the engine.
Nice.
That's what sort of was the inspiration behind that film. Just, up there, I don't know if you've been to Lincolnshire, but it's quite magical, up on the fens and watching or hearing the sound just drift across the fields. It's very magical, and hopefully the films do it justice.
It's going to be very cool. Have you done some historic racing yourself?
I've never raced anything other than my Grifter when I was about 15 years old. I've never raced a car. I've got to get in the car first and drive a historic car and see where it takes me. As I say, I'm not built for it. I think the idea of being able to get into the V16 ultimately and be able to drive it properly without racing it would certainly be an ambition of mine. How cool would that be? Not many people get the opportunity to do so. So if I get that opportunity, I feel extremely privileged.
Yeah, that's a great path to sort of set yourself off down. I've always found with my road cars and stuff like that, and race cars as well, but I've always wanted to sort of improve my driving skill to at least to the point where I can push the cars I'm pushing the cars. The cars are being pushed, not necessarily their ultimate lap time, but you're around about the limit and over it a little bit. And then you can be like, yeah, I've driven that car to a decent level. Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that. And now I'll go back and chill out on the road. When you get to that point with these, that will be, even just driving them moderately quickly, I think will be one of the most insane experiences ever.
It will be. Yeah, absolutely will be. I think, sat on that little seat behind, all that power of V16, will be mildly terrifying. I've got to grow some balls and get in there at some stage. It'll be an amazing opportunity and amazing experience.
I imagine there's some great stepping stones in between, smaller, safer stuff with no grip.
Yeah. Well, absolutely there are. P25, P48, I think are two cars that I think, we'd start with. I think, it's one of the things that we sort of talk about when we're just sort of bouncing ideas around the team is, maybe trying to sort of have a V16 driving experience, Some people are saying, well, why don't you build one with two seats and things like that? I don't think that's feasible. But if there is a way for certain people to go through a training course to be able to have a few laps in a V16 ultimately, wouldn't that be an amazing opportunity to be able to provide people But all these ideas are up in the air. But all I do know is that to drive one is pretty terrifying because the power comes in all in a rush. I think the power doubles when it hits a certain point on the rev counter. And you don't want to be doing that going around a corner. So it really does need to be treated with the respect it deserves. It's mildly terrifying.
Yeah, that would be for like the person that has called you up and gone, I can hear a V16. I'm sure that person, like if it was somehow possible, and it might just not be possible, to go, okay, we've set up some cones on a massive area and you can come and you drive this and then you drive this and you get like two laps or three laps in a V16, that would make people's like, would be serious, mean a lot to a lot of people, I think. But even just bringing it back and putting it out there is awesome.
No, absolutely. And it's sort of one of the things that we're talking about doing, and certainly one of the things that I'm personally very keen to do is, you know, having been at that auction in 1981 and watched, you know, my father and my uncle have to sell the family jewels, if you like, in terms of the BRM cars themselves, is, you know, for the next generation to be in a position to rebuild that squad, to rebuild the squad that we had to sell, to bring it back to BRM, bring it back to the Owen family, and possibly have a BRM driving experience, whereby, you know, we build those cars for people to actually drive, you know, possibly at Silverstone or somewhere like that. That to me would be the ultimate dream in terms of telling the BRM story and giving people the opportunity to see the cars. Because we talked a lot about the V16 and with good reason, but there were some incredibly beautiful cars right the way through to 1974. Mm. And, you know, so we've just started this journey. We've started, you know, as the latest film, The Genesis, sort of shows, we've gone back to the very beginning and we want to tell the story right the way through to 1974. And this year is about telling the story of 1962 and a certain Graham Hill winning the world championship for us over in South Africa. So, there's so many stories to tell. You know, when we're going through the archive, more and more stories keep coming out. And it's so rich in history, so rich in humor as well, and irony. And we've got so much to talk about, really, over the next decade and beyond.
Have you got any personal highlights of amusing things you've come across or interesting things you found?
Well, I don't know about amusing, because it probably isn't amusing, but yeah, someone was telling me the story of up at Fockingham on the launch of British Racing Motors, BRM, the great hope for the British racing team, the ambassador for Britain. All the press were there. The car was unveiled and Raymond Mays got in. He had a flu at the time, a temperature of 104 or something. So he was pretty ill. But he got in the car and did a few demo laps. And I think one of the camera crews got a camera up on top of an old car and strapped it, you know, the car to the top of the roof, and thought they'd do a sort of tracking shot of the V16 being driven down the runway, and it was all going fine, I think. And then, you know, all the vibrations, one of the leads came out of the camera, and, you know, unbeknown to the cameraman, who was obviously facing towards the car with the back to where he was going, there was a very low bridge. Ooh. And a very low bridge, which the driver seemingly thought wasn't low enough, but actually it turned out it would have been. But because the lead had fallen out of the camera, the cameraman quickly went down to collect the lead and put it just as they went under this low bridge. But would have it would have decapitated him. So that was a slice of luck on the first day of launch. But there's all these stories that are coming out. And the great thing is there's still quite a few mechanics and people that work with BRM still with us and still very much compos mentis and sort of telling us these stories that we're busy getting down on paper and looking to tell. I think the film The Chrysalis, which was about people's reactions, we were very fortunate to have Dick Salmon, one of the original BRM mechanics, who's now 96 years old, starred in the film, and he was responsible for changing the disc brakes, the drum brakes to disc brakes in period. So to speak with him and to be able to go down to the pub in Bourne and have a beer with him was an incredible privilege. And we actually got a few of the mechanics, John Sismi as well, and Dick, and we got them to Goodwood to watch 35 BRMs from 1949 or 1950 through to 74 go out one after the other. And incredibly proud moment for all of us and the BRM team to be able to do that. And, big thanks to Hall and Hall and to Goodwood for making that happen. But I turned to my old man, quite emotional and said, what was the highlight of your day? Expecting him to say, being here with you, son, watching all these beautiful cars go past. And he said, I think the highlight was definitely being with Dick Salmon, watching all those cars go out. So I think, that really gives you an idea of how revered, the Owen family, revere the people that actually did the hard graft and made it all possible. And to have Dick working with us on the film was absolute privilege. He's a legend. That's and he's cool. written a fascinating book as well.
Oh, nice. I'll check that out. So does that mean, because you're going to, presumably we're going to see more over the next, 10 years or so, have you said, are there going to be more cars that never got built, possibly getting built? Unknown.
Excellent question. Look, I think the best way to answer that is probably, hopefully.
Okay.
As I say, the whole thing about this project is telling the story and to have the cars out there running and racing. And if we can build a couple more that enable that to happen, then that's got to be a good thing. We're in a position to build them insofar as we've got the plans, we've got the IP, we own everything. We should do it. And I think that is the ambition. There's some beautiful cars that are too valuable now really to race. So why not build another one? So that they can be raced, as long as they're built to the exact specification and it's us building them, we're just building another car and we're able to do so. So we're in that privileged position to be able to, fulfill a dream. And it'd be very sad if we didn't take that opportunity, I think.
Yeah, sounds very cool. Well, that sounds like a pretty good point to sort of funnel into the way I normally wrap these up-ish. This can lead to God knows how much more time. Five questions. Do you have most memorable driving trip or journey? That's the first one.
Ooh. Yeah, that's a good question. I've got a few. I suppose probably driving a Holden Kingswood, a 1967 Holden Kingswood in Australia. Set off from Melbourne. I think I bought it for about a grand back in 1989. And I drove it to Ayers Rock via Adelaide on my own and nearly got hijacked by some locals on the long drive. But I couldn't go above 50 miles an hour. So I don't know how many thousands and thousands of miles it was, but it was a long voyage. So that sort of sticks in my mind as a good road trip. Arriving at Ayers Rock and being able to climb Ayers Rock, which you can't obviously do now, and photographing my Holden Kingswood nice. In front of Ayers Rock. That was that was quite a good voyage.
Was that limited to 50 miles an hour because the car couldn't go more than 50 miles an hour, or limited to 50 miles an hour because the speed limits are 50 miles an hour?
Good question. I think I was just wary that the car was probably on its last legs. It was pretty old, and I didn't want to break down. So, I was didn't have any money at the time, and I was living off watermelon juice. So I think anything safe on fuel as well would help.
That sounds like a rather epic one, that one.
That was a great car. It was absolutely hideous to drive. three on a tree, straight six, 3.3 liter, I think, with big gold bench seats and a gold roof. No aircon, obviously. It's pretty special car.
Cool. What road cars get you excited now?
To be honest, I have this debate with people, and I really get I can't get excited about all the big hypercars, this race to go faster and faster, and how quickly you can go. It just doesn't get me excited. For me, it's a combination of having a thrilling drive and something that takes your breath away every time you step out the door and see it on the drive. I think there's a number of cars from the 60s that I absolutely love. When I got married, I hired a soft top E-Type, and that was very, very special. A pig to drive, but beautiful to look at. So for me, if there was going to be a road car, it's got to have a combination of something that looks beautiful but goes quickly without anything ridiculous. I think people have got obsessed with how fast things go. I think they need to take a moment and look at the engineering and look at the aesthetics a little bit more. Who cares if it's got 0.1 of a drag less, because it's sleeker. I'd rather see it look more beautiful.
I think the ultimate sort of flip side to this chasing speed, which I totally understand why manufacturers do it, and I totally understand why people enjoy a bit of speed, is the fact that you can get a Tesla Model X. It's like a family SUV brick that I saw a drag race with a new 911 Turbo S, and they were like the same speed. You're like, well, I bought it because it's fast has gone out the window. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. I totally rest my case. It's for me, I think we need to sort of take a step back, and go and get a modern supercar, and then someone goes to a garage and gets out a beautiful car from the 60s. Guess what turns heads more? It's not the supercar. It's the beautiful car from the 60s.
Absolutely. And I think we are seeing that shift. I think a lot of people, the sort of classic time most people end up buying the supercar or the sports car is generally done well in life and they're treating themselves, or they've sold a business or, something. They've got to that point and they buy something that's current for at that time. So I think we're seeing a lot now, people doing the same situation, go buy a modern Ferrari or something, and they might have a modern Ferrari or they might have two. And then they're like, okay, maybe I want something a bit cooler, a bit different, a bit. And we're seeing, the resto mods and people just, I think the resto mod one I totally understand, because I love the looks of a variety of cars, but I don't want to drive an old car. It needs to work.
No.
Like, I would like a radio and, you know, that sort of stuff. And I totally get that.
I'd like a radio and for it,
to start.
And for it not to break down. Cause,
yes.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a beautiful Heritage Body Shell 1969 MGB Roadster. With the chrome bumpers, etc. And I used to drive around south of France thinking I was very cool with my girlfriend at the time, and invariably end up breaking down or the thing wouldn't start. And it got pretty frustrating, and I sold it. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's having those looks but with the reliability of a modern car. I can see the benefits in that.
And you do get, like, you'll have it with the, what is it you're saying, the magnetos have been upgraded. You'll have someone somewhere will be like, no, you should use the originals. And you're like, the car doesn't run.
Mm.
So
yeah,
would you rather see it run and rev to 11 and a half, 12? Like,
Yeah. No, exactly. I think when we're going through speaking to Hall and Hall, when they're going through trying to reverse engineer some parts of the car, they could see where the modifications had been made because either physically or for other reasons it didn't work.
Yeah.
So they sort of tweaked things along the way. So we were trying to build something from the original plans, but actually they tweaked it, as it went along. That car was always changing from the moment it was built. Actually we need more ventilation. Let's make some more louvers. Let's have a bigger vent at the front, et cetera, et cetera. So it was always evolving to get better and better. So what do? Do you build the very first one that was, potentially compromised? Or do you build one later on? And that's the debate. And actually, thankfully, we're going to do both. That very first car is going to be, that hasn't been seen for 70 years, is phenomenally special because it was Britain's first Formula One car. And that's what it looked like when it was unveiled to the world in 1949. But actually, that car evolved into something that Fangio drove very, very effectively in 1953, 1954, that blew all the other cars off the circuit. So we're going to be in a fantastic position of having both those cars, which is brilliant.
That's very cool. For the one that's been for the 53 car, were all the drawings there for all of the modifications, or was it you had the sort of the canvas, and then it's like a case of looking at all the photos, analyzing the cars that are around and stuff like that?
I believe some of those things. So you get out a sort of A1 beautifully hand-drawn drawing, which was to my mind unbelievably complicated, and then you'd have all these little numbers and lines, and those would be additional plans within the plans, and so you'd sort of be unearthing all this stuff, and then there'd be a combination of having to try and reverse engineer little bits. So it was an incredibly difficult sort of process that Hall and Hall went through to produce it, I've no idea how they did it. Hats off to them. Ask them. They'll be supremely modest, as they always are. But all you have to do is, I'll send you a picture afterwards of the car, pretty well built without any of the skin on, and you'll see just how complicated that thing is. Very special indeed.
Very cool. Right. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life.
Ooh.
Wait, sorry. You can drive one car for the rest of your life, any value, whatever, and you have £500 for a separate car.
Probably something quite fast but practical, something like an RS4. which does the job in many ways. I think that would be a good starter for 10. I know it's probably dull. There'll be a lot of people listening to this, you know, with their head in their hands. What, 500 quid for another car?
Yeah, so my reasoning on that is, like, you can get something super cheap if you just need, like, an old Passat to, like, carry stuff around in or whatever, and then you could have a sports car if you want, but it's totally however you want to do it.
Well, this is one for, yeah, I've got something in the garage that's worth about 500 quid, again, everyone will be reaching, with their head in their hand, a classic hairdresser's car. No disrespect to hairdressers, but I've got an Audi TT from 2000, which I had.
Is that like an original one?
Yeah. Which nice. I had from new.
Nice.
I've done 150,000 miles in it. It needs a bit of work, but I've had a lot of fun on that car, and I had it chipped and upgraded, and yeah, it goes pretty well. It's four-wheel drive. I'd probably dig that out of from beneath the dust sheet, I suppose.
they're like a modern kind of classic now.
If we had this conversation in 10, 15 years' time, I think we'll have a valid argument. I think right now they're still ridiculed. It's a great car. For the money now, I think it's good value. So I always had fun racing around in that hairdresser's car. So I'd probably have that.
Fair enough. What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What do you think should be worth more?
Every BRM. genuinely, I think, it's a forgotten brand, for the reasons we've discussed. And I think, I'm obviously going to say this, I'm biased, but I think when you look at the level of engineering and the drivers that drove those cars, they do represent phenomenal value. We had the best drivers in, driving for us. Clark aside, I think, Fangio, Gonzalez, Lauda, Hill, Stewart, Surtees, Parnell, Wharton, we had phenomenal drivers driving for us. And with the level of engineering that's in all those cars, and they're beautiful. They're some of the most beautiful racing cars. Again, I'm biased, but some of the most beautiful racing cars ever produced. I'm not alone in saying that. I know you're probably asking for a road car, but I'm going to say BRM. Yeah.
I guess it probably varies massively, but I mean, how much does it cost? Would it cost to buy? And then this is going to be where the massive difference is, like a 60s BRM. And I presumably, obviously 62, one, so that's going to be worth more. But like, what spread are we looking at?
Well, some of the cars just aren't available, aren't around. I think, again, I don't know, is the short answer, but I would have thought, some of the original V16? Cars, depending on... Well, again, there's only one for sale, and POA. I wouldn't be surprised if the original Bewley car, for example, chassis one, was worth 10 million quid. I can't verify that, but it wouldn't surprise me. So you get anything depending on condition and the provenance of the car, anything from, you know, probably $300,000 or $400,000 up to that figure, I would have thought. You know, I think the work that we're doing, you know, that those figures are only going to go north. It's very much part of British heritage. I think, you know, we need to tell that story. People will appreciate the mark and the brand and everything that went into it and how special it was as part of British motor racing history. It was an integral part of that. And, you know, hopefully if we do our job well, people will get to understand that.
Yeah, no, sounds pretty cool. Most interesting car to you at the moment?
Well, I was just watching, someone sent me a link to the H16 from the 60s. H16, which was basically two V8s on top of each other. it's quite an extraordinary engine, very, very heavy, probably pretty unreliable. But again, just going back to, you know, the madmen from BRM who came up with it, it's utterly ridiculous, incredibly complicated, but sounds beautiful. So I think that's an interesting car. Yeah, obviously we've talked a lot about the V16. Yeah, check out the H16. We just had a habit of, you know, we'd do something incredibly complicated and then we'd just go back to basics and do something very simple and that would be effective. And then we'd go back to doing something incredibly complicated again. And then, you know, there seemed to be this cycle of, well, that's worked. That was too easy. Let's do something much, much harder.
We need a challenge.
we need a new challenge. And that's for us here. What's the challenge going to be for BRM going forward? You know, we're telling the story. Yeah. We're bringing it back to life. We want to go racing. What does the future hold for us? You know, we don't know right now. All we're trying to do is build the brand and tell the story and hopefully go racing again. But who knows what's around the corner? I was looking at through some of the 20,000 drawings that we've got, and there's a prototype road car from the 60s, you know, beautiful looking prototype road car. Who knows where it's going to take us.
But plenty of options.
Plenty of options, but it's been a brilliant journey so far, a privileged one, an enjoyable one. We've got lots of great plans for 19, to celebrate this year. We're going to be at Shelsley Walsh, hopefully at Silverstone Classic. We're going to be at Revival. And all being well, we're going to do this sound recording of the V16.
Yeah.
You probably don't know.
At full chat. You're
probably too young. But yeah, full chat. But Nick Mason owned a Mark II that Bernie now owns. And he did a sound recording, I think it was 92, called Into the Red, of the V16 going some. And he set the benchmark, basically, and we've got to do a modern version of Into the Red. And nice. Hopefully that'll happen this year.
Yeah. Right, final question. Five-car garage, unlimited value.
Oh, God. I told you I'm not a petrol head. I've already told you two in there. I would have an E-type in there. I'd have
E-type RS4.
I'd have my hairdressers in there, just for old time's sake.
Two more.
A P261 BRM, which is my favorite. It's a beautiful car. I'd have that in there, and I'd have a V16 in there. Yeah, so a couple of race cars. Yeah, and a few road cars and a hairdresser's car.
Perfect. Perfect.
Lovely combination.
Any occasion.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I think, I'd probably have some of the old alphas are pretty beautiful from the 60s. Mm. So I'd certainly look at those. Yeah, there we go.
Cool. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.